It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and Sandwich Girl brings us our quick tip of the week with, have your lock screen wallpaper change daily, hourly, or whenever you choose, when you lock your phone or when you tap the lock screen, that sort of thing. In iOS, you go to Settings, tap Add New Wallpaper, choose Photo Shuffle, and you can choose the photos you want by search by word, favorites, any album that's in there, that sort of thing. Choose up to 50 different photos, and then you select the frequency on tap, on lock, hourly, or daily. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab 1086 for Monday, April 21st, 2025.
Welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in quick tips like that. You send in cool stuff found. You send in questions. We share all of them. And then with your questions, hopefully we answer them or at least provide a discussion on the troubleshooting path so that we can each learn at least five new things every single time we get together. Barebones.com with BB Edit is our sponsor for today. And yes, BB Edit is open on my Mac as I speak, as it always is. We'll talk more about why that is in a little bit. For now, here on Big Word Day, also World Creativity and Innovation Day. I wonder if those two go together. In Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And in New Hampshire also is Pilot Pete. Big Word Day. You know, if you need a big word, you got to go get the thesaurus. I'm just wondering, Dave, can you tell me what another word for thesaurus is?
I cannot. A big, long, big book with lots of words.
Yeah. Big Word Day when use becomes utilize and nobody stops you.
That's so. Right. Me becomes myself. That's right.
That's right. And yeah, I'm not just talking today. I'm articulating multisyllabically.
So. Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yes. All right. I'll stop now.
As long as there's no defenestration happening, Pete, everything's okay.
Well, there's that. It's Sesquipedalian Jubilation Day.
Right. We need to stop now because otherwise
please,
it won't end.
God, make it stop.
Because Adam is not here to stop us today. So we're on our own, Pete, and I don't know.
We are. Yeah. We are indeed. So I think I could be wrong. See, now I've hidden the top of the agenda from myself. No, it's your quick tip to move back into.
It is here on.
Because I opened with Sandwich Girl.
The police code today for 1086 is officer on duty. So Adam is off duty. So I don't know. Right. Yeah, I don't know what that means. But Adam had a last minute schedule conflict, unfortunately.
And for those wondering, Sandwich Girl is indeed my bride, and she had a passenger call. I heard that once on a flight. So she made the mistake of telling me, and it's been her call sign for 25 years.
That was the mistake indeed. Yep. All right. Andrew has our next quick tip that he read about on 9to5Mac. He says, in notes, type on your Mac, in notes on your Mac, type > twice. This now opens up a link to recent notes, or it opens up a list of recent notes. And then whatever note you choose, it puts a link to that in your note at that point. And this Andrew mentioned this in our Discord, and he says, and R. Stanley followed up and said, I think I heard about this on Mac Power Users, along with a follow-up tip that you can create a menu or favorites note, which is pinned to the top, which contains the links to those notes that you want to frequently access. So you can kind of use this in sort of a double stacked way there. That's pretty cool. I'll link to the discussion in Discord because there's some ideas in there about even more to do with notes with this. So I love quick tips that just open up functionality that I didn't even realize existed. So,
right. Yeah. And it's all just sitting there waiting to be discovered.
That's why we do what we do.
So,
yeah.
So this is one that was there, had long since been discovered, and then it disappeared in an iOS update, and Ben found the answer. This was also in our Discord help desk. So that's a great resource, by the way, is go to our Discord help desk chat and ask a question. It's like people are always on duty waiting to help you there.
Yeah.
Brian asked, you know, how do you force iOS photos to sync in iCloud? Because I'm on iOS 18 and the button at the bottom of the camera roll that was there in previous iterations is no longer there. And Ben points out, oh, it's there. It's been moved into your profile in Photos. So you look for your iCloud profile icon or photo at the top right of the Photos screen, click on that or tap on that, and you can force your photos to sync there. I don't know off the top of my head whether you need to go in and set it to do it or not do it on cellular, that kind of thing. Do you know off the top of your head?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. But I do know that I go there all the time to tell it to sync because it'll say, oh, yeah, I've paused my syncing because I'm on battery or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking in cellular here. I don't know where the right place to look would be. So I'm looking in iCloud photos and it doesn't say anything about where it's using it, but it might be in the cellular settings, which is the next place I'm going to check for us while we're chit-chatting here. But yes, so you can turn on, if you go into settings cellular, you can turn on or off photos for having access to cellular. So it does. I have it on for mine and it's pretty what's the right word? There's probably a really big word that I could use here on Big Word Day, Pete. But it's pretty intelligent about not using cellular data unnecessarily. So, but I also in setting cellular, if I go to my, you know, my Mint thing, I turn on low data mode for my cellular connection. As an overall thing. So yeah, if you go into cellular, and then it's either if you have multiple eSIMs, it's there as you know inside whichever eSIM you are using, but otherwise it's just in your cellular settings, and you get a low data mode, or a data mode option, and you can say allow more data on 5G standard or low data mode, and I've always left mine on low data mode because why burn data when I don't need to? So
sure.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing though. Did you notice, I want to say between 3 weeks and a month ago, Mint came out and said unlimited is now truly unlimited. For a while it would throttle after 30 gigs.
Okay.
And then I think they moved it to 40, and then they still had their unnecessary plans. They had unlimited and unnecessary, which was, I think, more tethering data. I'm not
okay.
Sure.
Yep.
But recently, did you notice that Mint said unlimited is unlimited? We're not going to throttle you anymore.
Huh? No,
on
I
your
didn't.
Unlimited plan.
I didn't notice. Yeah. I don't use an unlimited plan because I don't use an unlimited amount of data.
Oh, okay.
I use a fixed amount of data. Like on any given month, it might change, but yeah. So here's, I manage my family's Mint data, I'm a little bit crazy about it because I like to know, certainly unlimited is a nice concept for us because it relieves any concern over hitting our limits, but none of us use unlimited data there. We use an amount of data every month. And so what I do is I go in I have it on my calendar on the 27th of every month because our plans renew on the 28th. On the 27th of every month, I go into my Mint family account and I log the amount of data that each one of us has used. And that way I know, because Mint won't tell you what you used in previous months, or at least they don't make it easy to find. Right. So I go in on the 27th, I see how much we've used. And I've tracked that I catch it most months. There's sometimes if I'm traveling or whatever, I might miss it. And I know that like my data usage is, I'm on the 15 gig plan and I usually have somewhere between 8 and 10 gigs left at the end of each month.
Okay.
Yeah. So And I don't like obsess over, and I do turn low data mode on, but that's really kind of the only thing that I do to keep myself in check, if you will. But otherwise, I don't really worry about it. I know that if I want to use more data, I can just ratchet up to a bigger plan. Right. So that's why I wasn't aware that Mint was truly unlimited, because I don't have an unlimited plan.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah, I went at some point, I went to unlimited just because I hit it like twice in a year. I got throttled and it's like, ugh.
Yep.
Because, boy, yeah, when they throttle you, it's like you're on a 300 baud modem, man.
Right. Well, my feeling with that is, and this is part of why I don't, part of what allows me not to worry about it, is I know that I'm saving a bunch of money by not paying for more than 15 gigs every month, right? I think the Mint plans are, they go from 5 gigs to 15. If they had a 10 gig plan, I would buy that, but they're smart. They don't offer me that. Right.
Yeah.
So I know that if I hit my 15 in a given month, I can go buy US data on an eSIM for way less than what it would cost me to upgrade from the 15 to the 30 or whatever.
Boy,
the next
one
is.
Really good point.
For a whole year. Because I don't just get to upgrade for the month, right?
I
have to upgrade.
You're on the plan.
For the year. Right. That's how Mint works. And it's fine. I love that about Mint. But that's why I do that. Because I'm like, well, I can always go grab an eSIM real fast. You know, no problem. And even on a throttled connection, I'm pretty sure I can negotiate my way to buying an eSIM and then just switch my data to that for the rest of the month. And then that's that. And I'm done. So that's my mindset on that.
Yeah. Okay. And then in the comments, I noted that John asks, does Mint Mobile use the Verizon system? No, that's visible. Mint Mobile uses the T-Mobile system. In fact, they used to use the system. Now they are a wholly owned subsidiary of T-Mobile.
Yeah.
Is my understanding.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But I am seeing posts on Reddit confirming what you're saying, that Mint's unlimited plan is now truly unlimited data, works just like Metro, which was sort of the competitor for them there in terms of that. But yeah, so there you go.
Yeah, that was nice. So I don't know what their unnecessary plan is now, except maybe more tethering. I don't know, because their 10 gigabyte tethering is included with your unlimited plan. I don't know what's included on your. Do you know what your tethering is on your 15 gig plan?
I think I have 15 gigs worth of tethering. I think that's.
Oh wow!
I think that's how that works. But let's look. So I'm looking at Mint's thing. Of course, I get no. It doesn't. It doesn't share my screen anymore here, so you can't
because.
See it. But that's okay. I don't know why that went away. But anyway, so 12 months. It's 15 a month for 5 gigs, 20 a month for 15 gigs, 25 a month for 20 gigs, and then they are not offering anything.
Unnecessary went away.
Yeah, right now, though, it's interesting. They're saying, this isn't a new customer offer. They're saying unlimited for 12 months is $20 a month, which is the same price I'm paying for 15, Pete.
That's weird because...
So I should
I'm
call
them. I'm
definitely
paying 30 a month for...
Yeah. Huh.
No, I got to get in there and futz with it and see if I can...
Yeah, same.
You know.
Because I'll happily take the unlimited. Right.
Right?
Yeah, I don't care. Like... But yeah, okay. let me look at the, they are not offering an unreasonable plan anymore.
Yeah,
with your unlimited, I'm looking at your tethering. I don't know that it says it in an obvious way that I'm sure they tell you what it is.
Sure.
I'm just not seeing it quickly while we happen to be also doing a podcast. So,
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. So there's some tips, for that. Yeah, if you don't want to pay for more. But now I have to go talk to Mint and see if I can get them to bump me from 15 gigs to unlimited, because if it's the same price, I prefer
right.
that. Yeah. And I might not even have to talk to him. I might just log into my account. In the meantime, RG tells us about something that I had no idea even existed, Pete. And it's that iOS 18 now supports two language keyboards, not two keyboards of different languages, which of course it does. But when you do that, iOS 18 now will create a single keyboard of two languages. And he says this is really useful if you are wanting to enter a word or a sentence in a second language, or even just check a spelling in a second language. What makes this special is that the predictive text works simultaneously in both languages and does a good job of prompting in the right language based upon context. It's good enough that I sometimes wonder if it's a part of Apple intelligence, and I think it might be. If it can't decide which language is in use, it will provide the best match word in each language based on what you've already typed, and it can usually change seamlessly if you change language halfway through a sentence. Of course, not everyone needs this, but for anyone wanting to add a foreign word with an accent or check the spelling of a foreign place name, it can be very useful. It says, I'll also add that my foreign language skills are not so good. I need to use AI translation to send emails to friends, but I use this feature a lot because I live in Germany and I want to use German words and place names mixed while in with English and vice versa. I have three different two-language keyboards set up for the languages that I use, as well as single language keyboards, and also a keyboard for text expanders. Cycling through the keyboards using the globe symbol at the bottom left of the keyboard is straightforward. He says about setting these up, you go in to settings, general keyboards, dictation languages. That's he notes that that's where you set dictation. That's separate from keyboards. For the keyboards, you go to settings, general keyboard, keyboards, and then choose the first language of the pair, set the keyboard up, and then go back in and add the second language of the language pair. You can then choose which keyboard layout is shown when the keyboard pair is selected. This is amazing to me. I had no idea that this existed. And I bet my daughter living in an English-speaking person living in northern Italy where German is the primary language would love this functionality. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. That I have a hard enough time getting one language squared away.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's brilliant to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. So anyway, yeah, there's that's a thing. When he first wrote about it, I'm like, I had to write him back. So I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. Are you just telling us that you're using two keyboards? If so, like everything, the first time we find out about it, it's amazing. And if he's just now found out that you can have two keyboards, it doesn't make him it lesser than. It just means that he got to get joy from that today, whereas my joy from that is 10 years old or something. But no, it's more than that. And when he dug in, he's like, oh, no, I realize this is an iOS 18 thing. I'm like, I love it. So, yeah, fun stuff. Listener Lucas writes in and said, I just stumbled across the paste from other apps option in my iPhone settings. So if you have an iPhone or an iPad app that regularly asks if you want to allow content to be pasted from another app, and you always say the same answer, yes or no, this is the forever fix for you. Set it to allow or deny and never get asked again by that app. If you've missed this feature for 2+ years like me, Lucas says, start taking advantage of it now. So thank you for that, Lucas. I had no idea that that was there. So that's super handy. Yeah. Paste from other apps. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Thank you. All right. What else we got, Pete?
Well, so I've got a quick tip, and I panicked. I was looking all over. Where on earth in notes is my quick tip? Because I'm not finding it. And
it's not a note. I went through this too. Yes.
I did not put it in notes. I just did not. I said, you know what? I can actually remember this, but I forgot that I could remember.
The question is, can you remember it?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I can. And here's what happened to me. All of a sudden in my Finder sidebar, which I do display all the time, my favorites were at the bottom. And I'm like, why am I having to scroll all the way down to the bottom of my Finder sidebar to get to my favorites? What, you know?
Yeah.
So I grabbed favorites and I dragged them back to the top. Boom, done. I had no idea that those would move. So in your Finder sidebar, you have favorites and iCloud and locations. And in my case, I also have tags checked.
Yep.
But you can take, for instance, the word locations and drag it above iCloud or below iCloud or put tags near the
top. Yeah, right.
I had no idea you could reorganize that, but I did it just by, it just seemed natural. Hey, go try and drag that. And there it was, and it worked for me. There's no way to rearrange it in settings sidebar.
Okay.
You have to, at least not that I'm able to see, but you can drag those around as needed. It looks like you're just dragging the word and not the categories under the word. For instance, if you grab iCloud and start dragging it, only the word iCloud starts dragging. If you drag it below locations, it'll move iCloud below locations.
The whole iCloud thing below.
Yes. Yes. All those categories go with it.
Yeah.
And then you may notice off to the right of the word iCloud or locations or whatever, there's a little chevron pointing down, and that's just an expand or collapse. You can collapse your iCloud locations by clicking on that. So there's a second quick tip. Two for the price of one, folks.
I have a question for you, Pete.
I've got an answer. I'll make one up right now.
Yeah, and I don't know that we have an answer for this. I have my favorites at the top. That's where I like them to be. They stay there. Right below that is iCloud, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've leveraged this quick tip by putting things where I want them. I use documents and desktop syncing in iCloud, and I have noticed, and this has actually been a question from me on our agenda for probably 8 months now, rolling forward. I want my desktop folder to be in my favorites because that's the top thing on my Finder sidebar. And so I move the desktop folder into my favorites.
Guess what? Doesn't stay.
It stays initially.
Yeah.
I can put it there.
Away.
And then after a day, a week, I don't know how long, it goes away.
And here's the thing, Dave, and I don't know. I vaguely recall you and I working on this.
Yep.
Because I did the same thing with my desktop. I wanted it in my favorites because it's and it would be there for a while and then it would go away. Well, man, did I hose myself because now I had
desktop
in two different locations.
Wait.
Yeah.
Both of these things are true. They are unrelated. Your desktop issue was not your multiple desktop folder issue was not because you moved
it wasn't because I moved it. No,
you added
it was because for some reason I went in and created a second desktop.
Correct.
Folder.
Correct.
And because it wasn't there, I want it there. Damn it. And so I created the folder and boy, did that make a mess of things.
Yes.
So, let go and let Apple. But I don't know why it stays. It'll stay for a couple days and then it's gone again.
I know. Yep.
And oh man, does that hurt?
It just drives me crazy. It's like, dude, can we just leave it where it is? So I just want it to LITFA, and that's short for leave it alone. Then you can put the TF in there if you really want to, because I want to. But I have not tried this in months, so maybe one of the most recent updates has solved this problem. And if not, at least now we're talking about it on the show, which is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. So
we may actually have a show title there if you look at the bottom of our screen, Dave.
What's it says Schrodinger's desktop. Okay. Schrodinger's. I'm not sure how we're supposed to pronounce that word. Yeah, it's a big word, but Yeah. I like that. I'm eager to see what ChatGPT comes up with for an image for Schrodinger's desktop. First of all, right? we're not going to do it quite yet, but I also am always eager to see what ChatGPT makes me say when I tell all of us about our sponsors today. Because if you don't know, I started years ago having ChatGPT write my scripts for me for the ads, because what I found, the sponsors tell us that they want us to create a fresh you know, fresh read for every episode, which obviously is very easy for us. And it makes perfect sense. I get why they would want to do that. I'm on board. I want the reads to be fresh for you. I want them to be fresh for me. Right. But it makes perfect sense. And I love it. I'm all in. But what I noticed is that I was the filter between what we call the talking points, which is just the things that we're going to talk about. Yep. And a bullet pointed list generally of things that we're going to talk about, hence talking points, and what you heard. I was the Dave filter in the middle of this. And it turns out that even though the Dave filter was creating a fresh script every time, it was basically the same thing every time, because Dave's brain is a human brain and it really loves shortcuts.
Patterns.
Right? Yeah, patterns. Yeah, right. Yeah. So I was literally, I went back and I saw, I was like, dude, without even thinking about it, I'm almost saying verbatim the same thing. That's not great for all of you. And that's when I think it was you that turned me on to, like, why don't you use ChatGPT? I was like, oh my gosh, that's a great idea. And so I have been using ChatGPT for a very long time. And many of you have heard this before, but just for the sake of anyone here so that we can have some fun together, I tell it to, you know, keep it in my style, and B, make sure to find a way to incorporate our catchphrase into the ads, of course. And then C, I ask it to come up with something appropriate yet preposterous for me to say in the script. And we all generally get to find that out together, because I usually am able to do the scripts with one pass through. Sometimes if I realize what it said, like, I don't pre-read them is what I'm saying.
Right.
And so, but sometimes if I realize, oh, I can't say that, like, that sponsor is going to be super upset if I say this thing that ChatGPT had me say. So I have it rewrite the script and then it's fine. But usually you are hearing me discovering what it is having me say in the moment that you're hearing me say it. So that I just like to share that. So,
it's a wonderful writer, especially if you give it talking points.
Yeah. Right. You know, which you I know. Do. I feed it all the information. So, and it's still not perfect. Like, it will anyway, but I do have to check that our sponsors generally will give us a, what's called a call to action, which is like verbatim stuff to say at the end, like with perhaps their coupon code or something. And anything that is supposed to be read verbatim, I don't trust ChatGPT not to modify that. So I just look and read that verbatim, and like, there's no reason to take that risk. So,
just a quick tip on that then, Dave, I tell it here are the talking points, what I put in quotations, leave it verbatim.
Yeah, that's because
it does that for me.
But I upload the PDF. I don't copy paste anything. I upload the PDF to it.
Oh, gotcha.
And gotcha. And then there's I don't get to manipulate it. I just go.
Fair
there
enough.
You go. Yeah.
So. Yeah, that's true. You didn't used to, and I think I do that now too. You didn't used to be able to upload.
Correct.
Right to it. So.
Correct. Yeah. We have one last quick tip, Pete, and that is from listener Dan. Who shares some new tricks we can teach our Apple TV remotes. He says in settings remotes, there is a way to allow the Apple TV volume buttons to change your TV's volume buttons. But even after you get it working, it could just mysteriously stop working. After fighting with lots of settings, I found an article, which we will link to, if your volume buttons on your Apple TV remote aren't working, do what it says, and you probably can get your Apple TV remote to get it working again. And he says, while I was crawling around in the settings, I found that you can have your TV remote learn the functions of the Apple remote. It's a little confusing, and it's possible to assign the volume buttons so that they do navigation and volume at the same time, so don't get caught doing that. But also, depending on the TV, it might not help. He says, I've also found that turning on HDMI CEC on your TV may allow the Apple TV remote to turn on or off your TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tip I want to add to this, I love when my audio cuts out. That's just my favorite thing of the day.
That was me muting you, Dave.
Yeah. Crampy in, I really wish I could figure out what it was. Crampy in our Discord chat added to this and said, there are instructions to restart your Apple TV remote. And to do that, you press and hold both the TV Control Center button and the volume down button at the same time for about 5 seconds until the status light blinks rapidly. And they say that this quick fix can resolve connectivity issues, unresponsive buttons, and other common problems that might be frustrating for your viewing experience.
Yeah, I had to do that recently. Now that you mention it, that was very frustrating. When the remote was just acting up. That remote was acting up.
Wonky.
But here's one.
Hang on one second, Pete. I'm going to reset my audio one more time because it has to happen. And we're back. It's all good. Whatever happened, it had bumped my sample rate up so that I was hearing myself on a huge delay, which was really messing with my brain. So thank you for accommodating me on that. Sorry, continue, please.
Yeah, no worries. So a quick question, and Len, let's quickly move on if there isn't an obvious answer.
Sure.
So I have an LG TV. It turns out it's got three HDMI inputs. HDMI 2 of all of them is the ARC, which is the audio return
cable. Which sends audio from your TV back out to a soundbar if you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what I did. So I've got this Vizio soundbar because the audio speakers on the TV were crap on a good day.
Sure.
So turned that, bought that, put it all in. It seemed to work great, except about every 10 to 15 minutes, the audio soundbar seems to cut out. It will either mute or have slight cruddy audio from the TV speakers for about 4 or 5 seconds, and then it comes back on, and I'm getting good sound again, which is very frustrating because then I have to pause and back up and go, what did they say? I missed it. Any thoughts on why that is?
So it's interesting that we're having this conversation, which appears to be emerging of my audio cutout issue and then the Apple TV thing. So I love that.
What a segue.
It sounds, it could be the Vizio soundbar, right? I mean, it's possible that it just has an issue. Like, so I would, and I realize that, you know, isolation testing by either putting a different soundbar in there or putting that soundbar on a different TV is way easier said than done, but that would be a way of doing that. The other thing, and probably easier to implement, even if it might not be the solution, would be look at what kind of HDMI cable you've got. If you've got a cable that is not up to snuff, right? Because there's, you know, HDMI version 1.6 and hold your hat right and like all the different things.
Yeah, so, your tongue hot the left side of your mouth, not the right.
So getting, you know, an HDMI cable that is, you know, you get one that's good for 8K video or something, and that's going to have more than enough bandwidth. So that's where I would probably start with it.
That's the first one, sure.
Even though it's really not the best first step, it is the best first step because you don't have another TV to test this with. You don't have another soundbar to put in place. Like, you know, So I would hope that it's just the cable.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Yes.
Because what really chaps my kazoo, it was an open box from Best Buy, so a really good price. And then I threw the box away, so it's really can't return
it. It's yours now. Yeah,
it's mine. And the other thing that chaps me that I didn't realize I didn't have until I got it home was no Toslink cable.
Oh.
It would have been nice to have the ability to do that. Oh, I take that back. It has it. The TV doesn't have it.
Right. Well, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Toslink, which is the optical cable that we used to use or used for, you know, an interim period there is no copy protection or any of that going over optical. And you can't do all of the things. Like, I don't think you can, and I might be speaking out of turn, but I don't know that you can send more than 5.1 over an optical cable. Like, there are other limitations to the Toslink there. Maybe not that, but I know there were other reasons, and maybe somebody in the chat will help me here. But I know that the HDMI ARC is the thing that allowed Atmos to be sent from your TV to a soundbar. Like, it has all the copy protection, so it checks all the boxes for everybody to have allowed it to do all the things that it does. So that's why TVs no longer have the optical, the Toslink connectors. So we have some don't get caught things this week, Pete. I've noticed that this might be your favorite section of the show, and I don't know how I feel about that. But anyway, here we are. So Kai Engineer, Kentucky Engineer, wrote in and says, make sure that the drivers installed for your printer are the drivers supplied for that printer whenever possible. Recently, my new M4 MacBook Pro quit printing to both my Canon wide format and HP 8139E printers. I could not find the problem. I contacted Apple support, and while they were helpful, they could not solve it either. We did everything, restarted, loaded new drivers, booted in safe mode, etc. I had an M2 Mac Mini and had no problems printing. The case was elevated to the next level of support. Finally, I looked more closely at the drivers for both Macs. The Mac Mini had an HP OfficeJet Pro 8139E listed as its driver, while my MacBook Pro had a generic driver. When I first got the MacBook Pro, there were no problems printing. However, macOS was updated, and this is where the issue started. He's 80% sure. I think he's probably right. When I set up the printer, I used the default generic macOS provided drivers, but when I downloaded and installed the drivers from HP directly, the problem was solved. Yeah, using the manufacturer's drivers for your printer can be great. I will caution, as with everything, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. However,
fix it till it is.
That's right, Pete. Thank you for that. Appreciate that. But if it is broke, that's a good place to start. Because I've seen where you download the driver from the manufacturer, and maybe this is old now because Macs are way more popular, but there was a time where HP's Mac drivers would get ancient and not be compatible with the latest OS and cause all kinds of problems if you tried to shoehorn them in or whatever. But nowadays you're probably best off using the manufacturer's drivers when possible. Apple does try to keep them up to date in macOS because they want this to be friction free. They don't want you to have to go download drivers. They just want to be able to say, we've identified the printer and here's the exact right driver for it. But they don't always get it right. It just works. Yeah, most of the time it does.
Yeah.
And this is why Kentucky Engineer's tip is a good one, because it's easy to forget that you might actually need the manufacturer's drivers for your printer and even forget that they might actually even make them for you. So,
yeah. I got an interesting question asked of me yesterday on, I was on the phone with Garmin because I bought a update for my airplane's navigation.
Yeah.
Garmin. And the guy's like, well, are you Windows or Mac? And I said, well, I'm Mac. And he goes, oh, good. It'll work. Mac keeps it up.
Interesting.
On Windows, you have to download the drivers in order to get the card reader to work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's fair.
Yep. So everybody listening on Windows, go out and get yourself a Mac. It just works.
There was a point in time, and I know you are part of this crowd, Pete, where a lot of our listeners were people that were about to become switchers or had just been switched from.
Yeah.
But we would get a ton of email where people would say, I haven't yet switched to the Mac, but I started listening to your show to learn about it before I did. And I would never have thought to do that if I were in your shoes. But I think that's one of the smartest things anyone could do. If you are thinking about switching, especially switching platforms, because even if you have a good reason to switch from Mac to Windows or Windows to Mac, whichever, or iPhone to Android or Android to iPhone, the day you want to start learning about that platform is before the day that you buy the device for that platform, in my opinion.
Why won't this work?
Why doesn't this work? Oh, yeah, I've been osmosis learning this stuff. Like, oh, I heard those guys talk about this. It's a really smart move. I think it was great. And I'm sure it still happens. It's just not quite as common these days.
Right.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's because so many more people are on Macs.
On the Mac already.
than they used to be.
Exactly.
I mean, it's, once they went to the IBM or the Intel
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, when they went to Intel, yeah, that brought in a lot of switchers. And now that they're on their own again, it's an amazing, these are amazing chips.
Yep.
So,
anyway. Right, you got one more. Don't get caught.
So the listener Todd wrote in, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago, and it was about do my devices, let's see, I'm down at the bottom here. Does my device need to does my browser need to access devices on my local network?
Yes
or no? You know, and you talked about it and said, well, you know, if you need to print and that sort of thing, it may be. And then Todd sent in the article that talked about connecting to devices on your local network. And it goes into, you don't need to necessarily grant it that access because things that work on the built-in Apple services don't require you to give it access. So things that it will print via AirPrint, stream via AirPlay, share via AirDrop, or use HomeKit devices, that's okay. You they're going to work if you deny your browser access. So let me read it real quick. The bloated article speaks to the message in iOS. Oh, and by the way, the article only applies to iOS and iPad OS, but I did a little more search and it now really applies to Mac OS as well. It comes up and says, hey, you know, do you want to allow your browser access to things on your local network? And if you deny it, for the most part, you're going to be okay. If you would like to,
I'm going to stop this right here because this is getting confusing. And I disagree wholeheartedly with the sentiment. And I'll explain why.
Okay.
I think of all the apps you have, your browser is the one you would most likely want to give access to devices on your local network because you're going to want to connect to your router. If you have a Synology disk station, if you need to get to the web interface of your printer, all of those things are devices on your local network. And so
are you not going to be able to get there by addressing them by their IP address?
That's exactly what you are preventing when you say you can't access devices on your. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That is the distinction there is, do you want this thing to just have access to things on the internet, AKA devices past your router? Or do you want to let it talk to things on your local network? And there's good, I get the security part of this. There are good reasons for like saying, oh yeah, this app is only ever going to talk to a server on the internet. I don't want it to see anything on my local network. No, thank you.
Yeah, I don't want it gathering data about me and reporting back and that kind of stuff. So, okay.
But so in that sense, 100% yes, Todd, I totally agree. The browser specifically is the one thing that you're eventually most likely going to want to give access to your local network. That's all.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily, I overspoke. I overstated. I was hyperbolic. I don't wholeheartedly disagree with this. I just, the browser is probably not the best example to use. Is really
sure. And the two things that I really glean from it are if you click deny or you click allow and you want to change it, it's easy to go into settings, privacy and security, local network, and there it is. There's a list of everything you've allowed or denied access to see things on your local network. So settings, privacy and security, local network. Boom. You're in there and you can add or subtract from there as you want. And then the other part of that was something that is way over my head. It's for the developers, but it talks about the developers should explain the benefits or reasons the app would need local network access. And that's on the developers. There's a place in there when you're developing to explain why you want to be able to do this.
Correct. And it will appear, we've all seen it with apps that have taken this advice, and you see it on the screen, like on the little dialogue where it says, do you want to allow whatever it's asking you to allow? And there's a little message here that says, this is so that the app can do X. And it's like, okay, yes or no. So
So I'm sorry about being confusing up front there. This was a long article with a lot of information in it that gets very deep. But I think, did we put the article in the show notes?
We'll put the article in the show notes.
If you deny it, though, it says it will still allow print via AirPrint, stream via AirPlay,
That's
Shervy airdrop.
That was the interesting part to me is, okay, well, then why are so many apps now asking for this? Yeah. And it seems to be all the apps that in the past would ask for it only when I went to print. Like, that's when it would come up. And I'd be like, right. Okay, well, then sure. But I guess now I should just assume and say, no, I don't want to give you access to my local network and see if it can still print. Like, that would be the litmus test.
The test, sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I have an entry for Don't Get Caught this week, and it is about Thunderbird, because I'm the one that told us all about Thunderbird, and I've been using Thunderbird as my email client. I mentioned this casually in the show, and I kind of wanted to draw more attention to it, and I've linked to the bug report that I filed with the Thunderbird team on this, is that Thunderbird has an issue with its indexing function. And the indexing function is the thing that it uses to build its search database. So when you go to search your email, it doesn't search your messages or your mailbox individually. It just looks it up in this database that it has built and keeps up to date perpetually, right? Way more efficient, all makes good sense. Great. Here's the problem. I noticed that there were some emails that I knew I had and could even go find them, but were not showing up in the search results. And then I looked in the Thunderbird activity menu, the tools activity manager is what it's called. And I saw that the indexer was stuck on, you know, one of my larger mailboxes. And I have quite a few of those for archives over the years. And it was like, you know, indexing message 4532 of 25,000 or 12,000 or something. Right. And I'm like, okay. And then I looked 10 minutes later and it's message 4532 of 12,000. It's like, okay, it hasn't moved. Oh my gosh, what's going on here? And I would quit. The only way to get it to even try again was to quit Thunderbird, relaunch. But when it got to that mailbox, it would stop. And so it would not go to the next mailbox. So not only was it not indexing completely anyway, not completely indexing that mailbox, it's just like, that's it. The indexing process is a single thread. And if anything stops it, it just stops. And there's major problems with that. But the two major problems for me are, A, I didn't know this because there's no alert saying that it's having this problem.
Hey, I'm hung up. Yeah,
I'm hung up. And it's not failing gracefully and at least moving on to the next mailbox. So a mailbox that it does not have any issues, and why it has issues indexing, I don't know. But it should at least be at the very least, the user should know with a huge like red alert, your mail is not, your search results are not accurate, or at least incomplete. I don't want to say they're inaccurate, but they're not complete. And so I reported this bug thinking, wow, yeah, it's amazing. And it's been, as it always is with Thunderbird and their Bugzilla team and those folks. And I realize it's mostly volunteers, but not entirely. It's been months of this slowly progressing. Just this week, somebody was commenting and being helpful. It was like one of the community managers was like showing, okay, yeah, this is interesting. Here's my notes from 2009 about a conversation. And he pasted the conversation in where it confirmed that, yes, this would just blocks. And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? That this has been here for at least 16 years. What?
And good luck finding message 4532, by the way. So you could just delete it.
Yeah, and I have tried like rebuilding the mailbox, and that worked on a few things, but not all things. And they've been trying to have me, and I'm happy to try and help. Like, okay, this message, you know, could we figure out what the message is that's holding it up? And that is a problem to solve, but it is not the problem to solve. Like telling users, so I am here telling you, it is possible. If you're like me and you have mailboxes like me, it is highly likely, but certainly possible that your Thunderbird search results are incomplete at best. So just FYI, if you're using Thunderbird. Now, this is for the global search. If you are searching in a specific mailbox, because you can do that too. There's two different search functionalities. The search in a specific mailbox happens in real time, and the results are reliable. And that's how I was able to figure out that something was wrong, because I'm like, nope, there's the message. Why aren't you showing it here? And then that's when I dug. But yep, 16 years, at least.
That's so frustrating.
How is this not something that they're like waving the flag about? I don't know. I use both Thunderbird and Apple Mail. I have all my mail connected to both. And for searching, I use Apple Mail. I have to. I just jump to Apple Mail and I search there. So I just wanted to share that with you. I don't like to be Dave Doom and Gloom, but these are important things to know. I kind of feel like I did when I recommended the Drobo FS for months, and then
yeah, thanks a lot, Dave.
Yeah, I know, we all bought them, and then
Sporter.
This is weird. What's going on with my audio today? It's super. There's something. It's back. Whatever the issues are with audio and Mac OS. Oh, interesting. When that audio just hiccuped there, it also stopped sharing my screen into StreamYard.
Yeah,
there's something weird going on, dude. I don't know.
If only we had some geeks to help us answer these questions.
I know, but we do, and we will get to at least your questions, if not my questions. The next thing I want to do, though, is I want to talk about our sponsor. Because, look, if you're a Mac user who works with text, and, of course, that's all of us, you need our sponsor, BBEdit. Right now, it's open on my Mac, and that's both because it's part of my Start Podcasting script and my Begin the Day script. It's like the Swiss Army knife of text editors, but without the risk of poking yourself. Lately, I've been loving two features in particular. First, projects. BBEdit's projects feature lets me group related files, code, notes, show docs, even markdown stuff, to jump between them quickly and keep everything organized. It's like mission control for your text, minus the gravity. Second, ChatGPT worksheets. Yep. These let you have full conversations with ChatGPT inside of BBEdit. No copying, no browser tabs, no distractions, just you and your AI brainstorming buddy talking shop about regex or show titles or code, whatever it is you're writing, just like it's a normal Tuesday. No subscriptions, a generous 30-day full-featured trial, and perpetual licenses with great upgrade pricing made by folks who have been doing Mac software since before iTunes got weird. They've been doing this longer than we've been publishing Mac Geek Gab. And I paused there because I think they've been doing this longer than we were publishing even the Mac Observer. I think they started before we started that, right? So look, go to barebones.com/store. You can grab BBEdit. And remember, don't get caught editing text with anything less. And our thanks to our friends at Barebones for making BBEdit and for sponsoring this episode.
All right. Well, I think we should move to questions. And in the entire Don't Get Caught segment, I had the cool tips up still. So,
quick tips. So. Fun. All right.
So,
it's fine. Well, the show is, it's an audio show. As I say, we do a primarily audio show, and we stream the video and provide it on YouTube. For anyone who wants the voyeuristic experience of watching, well, today, two people record an audio podcast. There, and that's cool. I don't say that with any judgment. It's just a funny way to say it. That's all.
It's almost as exciting as watching paint dry. But anyway, so Russell writes in with this question, Dave. He says, looking at moving from a MacBook Pro with a large external screen to an M4 Mini with the screen, but I use the touch fingerprint key a lot as I work to unlock passwords and other security features as I have some secure information for my work. Don't want to have to type my long password every time for that. Is there an external touch button available to add alongside a keyboard, or can an iPhone be set to use touch or face recognition to unlock the secured items on the Mac Mini?
So I have answers here. I don't know that you're going to like the first one. You might love it a lot, except for the $199 that it costs, which is the Apple Magic Keyboard with Touch ID. This is a this is an external keyboard for your Mac that, with the magic of everything Apple does, has a Touch ID sensor in it and will unlock your Mac and do all the things that Touch ID can do on, you know, on like a MacBook Pro or something that has it, you know, a laptop that has it built in. So $199 though, and you've got to like the kind of keyboard that it is. It's the soft touch keyboard that Apple uses. It's not like the, you know, Battleship keyboards, the Extended Pro 2 or the Matias or whatever. To my knowledge, there is no official way for anyone other than Apple to release something with a Touch ID sensor for your Mac. So bear that in mind. However, if you have an Apple Watch, you can have it set to do a lot of the Touch ID style things and authentication that would happen with Touch ID simply by having your watch unlocked and on your wrist. So that might, if you already have an Apple Watch, then that might get you over that particular hump without even worrying about it. As far as using your phone to unlock, there is that app that's like BLE Unlock or something. What's it called? I want to find it here. Yeah. So it's called BLE Unlock, and I will put a link to the GitHub page in the show notes. And it says no iPhone app is required. It works with any Bluetooth low energy, that's what BLE devices, that periodically transmit signal from a static MAC address. So you can unlock your Mac when your phone is nearby without entering a password. You can have it lock your Mac when your device is farther away. And it works with an iPhone 5S or newer, any Apple Watch, and a Mac running with Bluetooth low energy support, which your Mac would have, and running 10.13, which is High Sierra or later. So I will put a link to BLE Unlock. It is free to download. And the latest release appears to be about a year ago. So let's hope it still works with current versions of macOS. But yeah, BLE Unlock would be the other thing to do there. So your mileage may vary, obviously, but yeah, that would be my, that would be my answer to that. So I don't think there's anything else.
That's the one I was trying to think of when you were doing it. My other guess was going to be the watch, but I didn't know that the watch will unlock the computer itself, but I'm not sure it will unlock the passwords.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, okay. I have mine prompt me for one password even all the time. Like,
I haven't properly set mine up then.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. For one password, you have to go into one password, and you need to be wearing your watch, and you need to go into one password and turn it on in the settings in there, whatever it is. I don't dare
stand
launch
on
one
your
password.
Right foot, close your left eye.
It's not quite that bad, but but you definitely have to go and enable it. And if you've got two Apple Watches, because you've got an old one that you wear sometimes, you have to enable it for both. So, yeah. But yeah, works fine. I find the watch unlocking for things like all the macOS stuff, not just limited to one password. I find it a little weird because you got to go and like double tap that side button, which if you get ahead of it, like if you do it before it prompts you to do it, now it puts your credit cards up on the screen and you get the whole thing going on. So it's a little bit wonky, but whatever.
Yeah.
It works fine. So.
All right.
Next question. Gary. Yeah. Gary has one for us here, Pete. He says,
it's a twofer.
Good day, MGG crew. I decided to take advantage of the Apple Card monthly payment plan and ordered a midnight black M4 15-inch MacBook Air. What would be the best and least expensive solution for backing it up, or at least to extend the amount of storage? I elected to get the baseline 256 gigs of storage and 16 gigs of unified RAM. I'm looking at a good backup solution for the content of its drive. I have a WD portable SSD serving as the Time Machine backup for my M1 24-inch iMac. since they will be linked to the same iCloud account. Should I buy another external drive for the MacBook Pro and just remember to carry it around when I take the laptop away from the house? And then I'll ask his second question later. So
okay.
We'll do this as a twofer with two prongs. Yeah.
There you go. So I answered, and then somehow I missed in there. He'd already ordered it. So this is for other people considering the same thing. I said, you know, like anything on a question like this, it's nebulous, right? I mean, I can't definitively answer your question for you, because it's you and your use case, whereas, you know, mine is different. I said, I'll tell you what I would do. And I'd say I'd buy at least a 500 gigabyte and consider a 1 terabyte drive. And some people, they can get away with a 256. I find it amazing that Apple still even offers that version, that the 256 is a base, but there it is. And then I'd use an external 500 gig or 1 terabyte USB drive and consider a versioning backup like Time Machine. I said, I have a 1 terabyte in my MacBook Pro. And then what I do is my backup is I clone that once a week with a USB drive, a 2 terabyte USB drive. But for anybody considering getting a base model, if you can afford it, I would get at least the 500 gigabyte. That doesn't help Gary. He's got the 256. So I think, getting a large USB solid state drive, I think you've just spent more than what you would have spent on the...
Well, not necessarily. Apple storage is way overpriced.
Yeah. We all know Apple storage is not free in any way, shape, or form.
For $100, you can get an external, you know, 1 terabyte USB or maybe even less, right?
Yeah.
So, but, you know, if you take advantage of what was your comment before was let go and let Apple, right? So if you let go and let Apple and you have the 256 gig storage, and I know there's many of you out there listening that do, right? Because Apple sells lots of these things, so it stands to reason that and you let it do, you know, optimized storage, and you do the documents and desktop syncing and put all your documents in your documents folder so that your Mac can aggressively move things off to the cloud.
Into the cloud.
Yeah. Then maybe it's going to work out. It depends on what you're doing with it, obviously. It depends on...
I never considered that, Dave. Yeah, that it does the optimized storage really... It's good at that.
It is good at it, yeah. Now, the only question is 256 enough to keep all your apps and your apps data separate from your documents? But otherwise, and you might need to aggressively kind of manage your downloads folder. You can use Hazel for that, right? Which is a great, it's folder actions essentially. So you can say, and it comes with a great set of default ones for your downloads folder so that you really get to see how it manages it. And it's a good example too, but Hazel would be my recommendation to keep your downloads folder in check. And, I think it'll probably work okay. Where I get into trouble with that is mail. And it's because I choose to store all my mail locally, but you don't have to. You can also store that in the cloud and just pull down. Because I also keep decades and decades of mail, you know, somewhere. So wanting to keep that on my laptop or have access to it on my laptop, you know, I have easily over 100 gigs of mail. I know. I'm Dave. And I have a problem.
Well, there's that. So.
But that's me. So I think it's workable with 256. I'm tempted, but I'm not going to look on this computer because it's only got 512 to see how much of my. I mean, I have 13 gigs available on this 512 drive here, but I have all kinds of apps installed. I keep all my mail on here. I have like all the things, right? Although actually my mail is stored on an external drive. So, but I'm doing a lot of audio recording and even the 13 gigs is kind of making me sweat a little bit right now. But, I leverage Hazel aggressively. So what I wanted to look at was how much my applications folder takes up on this computer, because that would be an interesting data point to share. But given all the audio issues that have been happening here today, I'm not entirely tempted to do that. Yeah, I don't I don't have it pre-calculated, so I'm not going to calculate that now. But yeah.
And letting it do the optimization, the only other thing I would say is that we make sure you do some pre-planning if you're going to be, for instance, off the grid on an airplane or something like that, where you know you're going to want to work on some documents, that you've got those on board, that they aren't only in the cloud with a link to them.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, that's the only issue with that is right, making sure that you have for offline use what you need for offline use. But if you're going to be connected most of the time, my guess is that I know there's a way it's going to work out, because that's the limitation you have. And so you're going to find a way to make it work and share with us. In fact, I'm really curious. Yeah. I know there's a lot of you that have Macs with 256 gigs. And I also know that the way we speak here, it's unfathomable for us to have these. It would have been unfathomable for me here in the studio to have a 512 gig drive, but it was the computer that was available on the day that my other one got burned up by lightning. And so it's what I have. And I had an issue migrating to it because my previous machine had a 1 terabyte drive. But you find a way to make it work, and then it's just fine. And once so I want to hear from you. What are your systems? How do you? I don't want to make this sound negative. What are your systems for making it work with 256 gigs? Feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
You heard him. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
That's feedback at MacGeekGab.com. We have time to keep going. Okay, so Gary had a second comment question here. He says, adding to your discussion about toner, ink, and waste cartridges, you guys may have forgotten that manufacturers often have a chip on those cartridges, ink cartridges especially, that reports to an ink monitor built into the printer. Even if you empty the waste ink container, refill the cartridges, etc., unless you either reset or replace that chip, the machine will still think it's used and not let you continue printing. There are places that sell chip resetters, and there is software on the Windows side that's supposed to erase those. But a lot of the printer manufacturers have gone to a rotating serial number using a formula only they know. There is a serial number embedded into the chip, so unless you can get your hands on a chip and are willing to melt the epoxy and replace the chip, it may not be worth it to keep using the same cartridge. I had a similar issue with drives and my Drobos in the old days. If a Drobo decided a drive was dead, I couldn't take it out, reformat it somewhere else, get it up, back up and running, and put it in. It would be like, no, I know this drive. I've seen this drive before. You're not allowed to put it in.
Yeah.
So, thoughts on that, Pete?
Well, yeah. So, first of all, I think I may have conflated, because in that discussion, I distinctly remember talking about refillable and all that. So, I may have conflated an inkjet refill, which my mother-in-law had recently bought. I believe it was a Canon that they're designed to be refilled. They sell you the little bottles of ink that you just pour in.
Right.
Those are much cheaper than they used
built.
To be.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So those are kind of cool. I really do like those. And I was saying that I have a laser printer. I think, is it inkjetsuperstore.com? We've seen a couple of people write in about that.
Yep.
Yep,
for sure.
So, and I had actually used those. So my laser cartridges, I buy those. I had been using Inkjet Superstore. I found them actually cheaper on Amazon. Again, sometimes you get what you pay for. I have not been burned by these that I've gotten on Amazon. I've been very happy with them. And my, it's a Brother 930 CW. Man, that thing, that's got to be a 10 or 12 year old printer now. It thing is just cranking and cranking. It was the waste toner cartridge that I looked on YouTube, how do you empty this and, you know, not give yourself lung cancer if you happen to be downwind of all the crap coming out of there. That thing, you can do it, you can empty it. And I saw that the way that one seemed to work was, the crude analogy is like the float valve on the toilet. It the waste toner fills up and it moves this little lever and says, hey, I'm full. But I decided, you know what, I think it was $26 or something for a new waste cartridge.
Yep.
So I just did that rather than mess with the other. But yeah, there's no way I would mess with trying to refill a laser printer cartridge.
I think there are some that you that are built to do that, but otherwise, yeah, I agree with you.
You're just, you know, unless you like driving yourself crazy.
You like suffering, sir. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So, there's several people have written in about it. It was Inkjet Superstore.
Yeah, Michael DJ was the one that we had queued up. But yeah. So, yep. Yeah. So, thank you for that.
So, Michael. I didn't mean to conflate the two, though. The refillable inkjet ones now are pretty cool and substantially lower priced than they were recently.
Yes.
Although they're probably still $100 a gallon for ink.
Oh, it's more expensive than airplane fuel, I bet. So, right? Yep.
Yeah.
All right. We are close to our limit here. I wanted to take a minute and thank the two people that sent in reviews in the last week here. The first one comes from RG80G17 in the UK. 5 stars. Outstanding. ... is the title. That sounds ominous. But it's not. There are plenty of Mac podcasts, RGA says. Several of them very good, but MGG stands out for the fully interactive content as well as the expertise. This is the podcast where the agenda is mostly driven by listener viewer input, which is more useful and relevant for many people. Expertise is needed, and no shortage of it in this podcast, but 2 or 3 experts can't cover the range of cool stuff found, nor the real life issues and problems, nor the helpful warnings of don't get caught items and the MGG that the MGG audience all contributes. And if you do get in touch, the interaction is friendly, helpful, and positive. The aim is clearly to share and assist, not to show off or be clever. Production quality is first class, except for today. And although very much USA style, it works well for European and indeed worldwide listeners. Russell. Thank you, Russell. Amazing. That's nice. Yeah, that I love that. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. And we got another one from Dude Man LA. And so being Pilot Pete, I have to ask, is LA Los Angeles, Louisiana, or Lower Alabama? Asking for a friend.
Fair.
Which is the Florida Panhandle, Lower Alabama. So, all right. Love the Mac Geek Gab podcast. He says, I really like this podcast. I've been listening to it for a long time now, and it's the best out there for Mac, iPad, iPhone, troubleshooting, useful tips, finding cool new software, and more. I learned so many great tips and troubleshooting techniques. Dave, Adam, and Pilot P are very knowledgeable and entertaining. I always learned something, at least 5 new things.
Amazing. Love that. Love that. Yeah. Thank you, Dude Man LA. No matter where you are, LA.
That's right.
And while we're here, I do want to thank everyone whose contributions have come in since the last time we talked about this, which I think is about 3 weeks ago. So starting with thank you, Brian in Glendora, for a $150 contribution. Thank you very much. It's very kind and generous of you. James in Chugiak and Stephen in Woodland, thank you each for your $100 contributions. You both rock. Thank you, Stephen in New York, for your $60 contribution. Thank you to Patrick R. in Little Rock, Edward in Manhattan Beach, and John in Studio City for your $50 contributions. You all rock. Jimmy in Cushing and Sandro in Garnet Valley, thank you to both of you for your $30 contributions. Thanks to the following for your $25 contributions. Robin in Andover, Ralph in Bangor, Andrew in Bellington, Craig in Costa Mesa, Bruce in Decatur, Gene in Denver, Susan in Honolulu, Donald in Jamaica Plain, George in Natick, Roger in North Charleston, Scott in North Little Rock, Colby in Otis, Paul in Pomona, Michelle in Quebec, Mike in Raleigh, Rob in South Hurstville, Kurt in Towanda, David in Troutdale, Robert in Westford, sorry, I almost said that wrong, Chris in Windsor, Jeffrey in Windsor in a different state, Jonathan in Woodside, and Andy in Durham. Thanks to each of you for those $25 contributions. Thanks to John in Narrowsboro and Robert in Wakefield for your $20 contributions. And the following thanks for your $10 contributions: Wagner in Allen, Peter in Auburn, Scott in Bourbonnais, Jason in Charlestown, Chris in Charleywood, Robert in Columbiana, Mark in Coopersburg, Stephen in Costa Mesa, Jeremiah in Edgewater, Donald in Furlong, Nick in Marquette, James in Melbourne, Anthony in Middleborough, Santiago in Palm City, Cal in Russellville, James in San Antonio. There was somebody else in San Antonio, wasn't there? Anyway, Abel in Santa Rosa, Phil in Summers, Brian in Southbury, Mark in Vero Beach, John in Wake Forest, Neil in West Hartford, and Timothy in West Windsor. You all rock. As we always say, our premium program is optional and very, very much appreciated. You can learn more at mattgeekab.com/premium, and your support really is a huge part of what allows us to keep doing what we get to.
It's so humbling that, you know, amazing. People crack their wallets open and share their hard earned money with us to keep this going.
It truly is. I know.
Thank you.
That's the right word, humbling. And the reviews, especially, you know, what's been said in the reviews recently, are really humbling too. I know we ask you for your reviews and we always ask you for your 5-star reviews because that's what we're told to ask.
Not 4, not 3.
That's right. Yep. But
find another show to give that 3-star review
right.
to.
Well, but I think it's pretty obvious that we are students of this craft. We like to get it. I say get it right implies that we could possibly know all the right answers. We don't. We like to get it as great for you as it possibly can be and as valuable for you as it possibly can be and hopefully as entertaining so that, you know, 75 minutes
so
of
you
your
come
time.
Back.
Yeah, exactly. but like we work really hard at this and the comments in the reviews, I love the 5 stars. Don't get me wrong. 5 stars means a lot to other people, right? That go look at the show. How many 5-star reviews does it have? So that's where that matters. What really hits me is the specific comments that you give where it's like was it RG's? I kept saying RJ. RG's, Russell's, that's easier to say. The one that I read today where, you know, saying that like we know we can't have all the answers and that we're leveraging the community and all of the things that we work really hard to do, hearing you echo those back to us says, okay, like it's working. I love it. And I know
we occasionally are getting it right.
And we do occasionally get it right, but we also occasionally get it wrong. That's okay. We're teaching the process and we're helping everyone, including the three of us, level up. And that's why.
And we're trainable. Constructive criticism is a good thing.
Oh, 100%. So
we take that under advisement and then I go sit in the corner for a week.
That's right. Well, sometimes I have to sit in the corner, but that's okay. It's all of us. Yeah. So thank you. Seriously. It means a lot. And so
Dave, I had so much fun. I think I'd like to come back and do this again next week.
Maybe we'll get Adam to join us, man. That'd be cool. Yeah. The April giveaway here is Clean My Mac. So go to MacGeekGab.com. Let me try that again. Go to MacGeekGab.com/giveaway. And you can sign up for the giveaway there. There are 5 copies of Clean My Mac being given away this month, and you have a good chance of winning one. So, yeah. And we have some fun giveaways coming up next month. Yes, Pete.
Yeah. John asks, where do we repost the reviews? Where?
Ooh, great question. MacGeekGab.com/review. That is the closest we can get you to the place where to leave reviews, but it works pretty well. Go to MacGeekGab.com/review. We've partnered with the folks at Podgagement to really facilitate. They do a great job of facilitating all that review stuff. So, yeah, it's great. It's good. Thanks to all of you for listening. That's it. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And, of course, thanks for sending in your feedback to feedback@MacGeekGab.com. Thanks to the folks at CashFly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. If you missed hearing Adam's dulcet tones this week, you can hear him and his daughter, Kenny, on their debut film podcast. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can hear more of Pete at So There I Was, his podcast for aviation enthusiasts. And if you really feel like you need to hear more of me, I do 2 other shows, Business Brain and Gig Gab, the first for entrepreneurs and the second for working musicians. Thanks for hanging out.
You've had some amazing gig gabs lately, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah, we're having fun with that show. We have some amazing ones coming up, too. I like them to be a surprise sometimes. So, but
there you go.
But yeah, we've got Prince's, the guy who was Prince's sound engineer for a long time, and amazing stories like the things that Prince thought about, dude.
Yeah,
dude,
you told me. Oh my god,
it's crazy. Yeah, Pete. Neither one of us wore the shirt today. I didn't wear my shirt because I thought you'd wear yours. So I should have texted
you. Well, yeah. I didn't even think about that. But yeah.
What does your shirt usually say, though? It's good advice.
Non adepto de princes. Oh, that's Latin for don't get caught.
I thought that was just your big word of the day.
That too. See ya.
Later.